Good morning. It's good to be with you all. Cheryl, Zach, wherever you are, Abby, Owen. I know this was the solo Cheryl show this morning. And I have a lot of empathy, Cheryl, for that feeling of of juggling when you're doing this by yourself, being the being the person speaking or singing or what have you, and also the technician and also the person feeding the information onto the into the broadcast and excuse me, sort of the whole thing, you know. But that was lovely, and I'm so intrigued whenever this happens, and it happens quite a lot. I've touched on it before, but I'm always a little bit I have a sense of wonder when this happens. I know where I'm headed today, and some of the things that felt like they've come out of my mind and my spirit and my life experiences this week as I've prepared. And often the musicians and the people who lead our community time end up talking about their lives and experiences in ways that feel like there's just so much overlap. We must have been in a planning meeting together, you know? But we weren't. And it suggests to me some things about our shared life that I find intriguing and lovely. We have more in common than we think we have, I think, most of the time. We'll get to that in terms of where I'm headed this morning, but let me begin by reminding us that we gather on Treaty One land today and every day. This is where we live. And if you are somebody with settler ancestry or heritage, let me, because this is a time block that I have some discretion with, let me offer you this moment to be consciously grateful for our welcome, both in the past and in the present. I was reminded again this week by an email from Teresa of the ongoing impact of the systemic breakdown of that agreement in everyone's lives. And having said everyone's lives, I also want to center the experience of Indigenous persons and lives, because that's where the impact has been overwhelmingly destructive and negative, and where the reparation, the restoration, the reconciliation work needs to be done. And when we stop and remember that we've been made welcome by the First Peoples of this continent, those are things that sometimes get twigged for us. We get reminded of them, and we need to be reminded of them. Rhythms are important in our lives. Cheryl, you touched on this as well in what you were talking about. An obvious example is our heartbeat. If that rhythm changes too much, and we have medical language for some of those changes, one of them is dysrhythmia. You know, it's interesting how our medical terms reflect the importance of rhythm. If our heartbeat and its rhythms changes too much, we're concerned about it. We try to address it. When we walk or when we run, a big part of what keeps us balanced is rhythm. As you would know if you've ever tried to run on an uneven surface or a trail or something like that, we have these rhythms of things like sleeping and waking, eating and digesting, talking and listening. We could go on. There's so many ways in which our lives make it clear that rhythm matters. And then we have societal and social rhythms, some of which are associated with the seasons. And Cheryl, you talked about this as well. When those rhythms get messed with or challenged, that can be hard to process, right? So for many of us, this time of the year is back to school time. Misty, you talked about this, how even though you don't have kids in school and you're not going back to school, that's not part of the rhythm of your life. It still feels I don't know, like something should change now. Something starts up, and things do start up, right? I mean, you know, we even if school isn't the thing, this is back to certain work rhythms time for many of us, back to meetings and appointments and activities, shared activities, social activities, those kind of things that get suspended. Regular meetings often aren't as regular because so and so's away on vacation, and even if we work right through, you know, this stuff shifts a bit, right? Here's the thing. Even if we love what we do, if it's about returning to a different rhythm in work, or even if we're excited about going back to school, Tyrion said the other day, I can't wait for school to start. What a lovely thing to hear from one of your kids that's a student. Even if we really miss whatever community engagements we might have sort of suspended or rearranged over the summer, we can still feel the return of all of those things at this time of the year as a weight, if you will. Excuse me. And in the life of the table, this weekend was often sort of our coming back to the table weekend. This is when people kind of came back from the cottage and came back from whatever they were doing, and showed up in person again. And there was a bit more of a, critical mass in the room. The past 2 years, almost 2 years, I guess, right? We're headed that way. Have been hard on pretty much all of those things, and we might find ourselves feeling that the normal demands of September have a bit or maybe a lot of sort of extra heft to them. So I would say, in light of some of that, that now is not the time to abandon the rhythms over which we have some agency. In the middle of all of that September on-ramping and onboarding and getting back to things and starting up again, I would say it's as important as ever to pause and attend to the core beats of our lives, which in an embodied sense are things like our breath and our heartbeat. I want to invite us this morning, and it's always an invitation, never an obligation. I want to invite us this morning to be still for a minute and just to listen to our breath and our heartbeat and to be grateful for that core stuff of life itself. All right, so let's take a moment to be still and breathe and just be aware of your breath in, held out, and of your pulse. You might even want to sit with the fingers of one hand on the major artery in your wrist with the other and feel your heartbeat. Okay? So let's be still and feel our breath and our pulse. Thank you. It was so lovely to gather with some of you in person last Sunday. I don't even really have adequate words for what it felt like to see your faces and to hear your voices, not mediated by a screen. Grateful for this way of gathering and being connected, of course. And also, it was pretty great to not have all of this sort of necessary stuff involved, and just the distance of it. It was beautiful to be with people in a whole body kind of way. I know that there were some folks that wanted to be there and couldn't. There were others that are not comfortable with that sort of gathering or not quite feeling ready to be out and about yet under the circumstances, particularly with their young ones, with their unvaccinated kids. Collectively, we're still not sure what gathering in person looks like going forward, of course, but I want you to know that as we, as the community, and as the leadership team within that community explore those options, our commitment is to continue with live streaming, at least portions of our gatherings, and to continue the podcasts. So there will be options for people that are unable or not inclined, to be a part of whatever in-person gathering looks like when we get there, whenever we get there. And I realize that that's part of the ongoing gigantic global social experiment that we're a part of. By the way, just in case anyone out there would misconstrue that, global experiment is a reflection of the fact that we've never been here before. From my perspective, not that we are being experimented on in some nefarious way. Because we were outdoors last Sunday, whatever I was doing and concentrating on, I could always simultaneously hear the kids playing, and they were running around the yard and just having adventures in the space outdoors. And that was in particular a big part of what made that morning feel really special to me, because and I guess the other thing that made it kind of unique and special was getting a pie in my face from Atticus. Thank you, Atticus, for your excellent aim and gentle delivery. Now, I did get to reciprocate. I got that pie, Atticus, as well. If you haven't seen that, there's a video of it up on the Facebook page. Thank you to Tim Penner for that. That's going to show up, I'm sure, in every goodie reel, video goodie reel of Atticus's life for the rest of his life. It was a great moment. And just a reminder, because not everyone would be aware of this, that it was a marker of a community initiative to raise some funds to help pay the bills for the table. And we said if we raised X amount in a certain amount of time, this would be what would happen, is Tim would get a pie in the face. And then Atticus thought that, because he was the deliverer of that pie, it sounded like fun to him, just so you know, it was his idea to have the experience as well. And so that's how that happened. It took a long time for that to happen, because of all the delays with in person. And so that was just felt like another one of those suspended things, but when it finally did happen, it made the morning feel pretty special, certainly unique. All to say this, I miss you. I miss all of you. And if I may, I especially miss the kids. I know it's a cliche, but they do change so fast. And they change in ways that are visible and that are audible and that are remarkable and astonishing and also kind of heart achy, And I sometimes wonder about that achy part. Like, what's that about? Because even though kids, growing up is sad, it's not just sad, is it? I mean, we expect that. We want to see kids grow and develop. If we're parents, we do our best to facilitate exactly that. We try to give our kids anything that we can that will help them move forward in their lives. And at the same time, it's kind of hard to watch. Maybe part of it is the sense that we're watching someone grow beyond the joyous aspects of innocence. We're watching someone moving beyond this stage where they're largely unaware of the struggles of life. Maybe it's about the way our connection to kids changes as they move toward independence. I suspect it's all those things and many more. And as someone with adult kids, I would just say that as far as I can tell, that never stops. That combination of seeing your kids move through the world in more and more sort of adult ways, and feeling joy about that, and also feeling a kind of ache in your spirit about it. And as an adult, I would also say that in my experience, personal growth in my life and those of other adults around me contains a similar blend of joy and struggle. Life is complicated, change is challenging, growth can be painful. If I was in a different religious tradition right now, I might say something like, "I'll testify. Can I get a witness?" And I expect I would get a witness, And it kind of almost goes without saying that when we go exploring in a realm like stages of doubt and belief, that same kind of mixture of experiences is going to be there. I feel especially conscious of these dynamics at this juncture because we're about to begin digging deeper into the details of that stage three experience. When I introduced this last week, one of the things I felt some strong resonance with was the idea that this is a stage that is well labeled as perplexity. That's sort of the one word identifier for it. And just as an aside, one of the reasons for these identifying words is so we can have something to push back on, so as a community. If we're used to being in environments where, we're teaching is treated as authoritative and not open to being challenged. Stage one and stage two environments are often like that. We might need a refresher on how this works at the table. Whenever I'm putting out there in a talky bit is intended to be catalytic for your exploration of what you believe. It's not intended to be the last word. And as someone reminded me again this past week, it might not even be sort of the right word or words, in the sense that sometimes a word that represents something well for me can be a total miss for somebody else. And I love it when people get in touch with me to say things like, "Well, that didn't work for me," or "Did you mean this and not that?" Or even just kind of like, "Seriously? Like that's what you think about that?" Anyway, I kind of like perplexity in this context, so I'm going to stick with it. But let me know what kind of language around these ideas would work for you. I find those one word sort of signifiers helpful because I feel like I can put them in my mental wallet and carry them with me more easily than a sentence or a bigger idea somehow. But here's a question. What might underpin that experience of perplexity as it relates to exploring belief and doubt? What might underpin that experience of perplexity as it relates to exploring belief and doubt? Well, that's probably as varied as our experiences of religion have been, but I want to offer one lens for our consideration this morning. I had occasion this past weekend to watch a piece of experimental online theater that had as one of its central ideas wrestling with a particular line from Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream. And the shared experience of the main character of the play, who is sort of a struggling Shakespearean scholar, and the character's father, who never appears on screen but we hear their voice, who is a veteran Shakespeare actor and interpreter, the shared experience that those two characters had with this particular line from that play was, "I don't know what that line means." And I won't get into this too much today, but one of the upshots of them not knowing what that line meant was that it got harder and harder for the characters in the play to know what was real at all. And in the artist talk afterward, the play's director made a comparison between what it's like for a thoughtful interpreter of Shakespeare to have an experience like that, and what it might be like for someone that grew up around the Bible as sacred text to have an experience like that. Here's the thing. That might seem like a curious comparison, but it actually sort of makes sense, I think. When guiding stories, including texts that we may have been taught are sacrosanct, and the word sacrosanct just means regarded as too important or valuable to be interfered with. When guiding stories or texts cease to have apparent or clear meaning for us, it can be quite disconcerting. And for some of us, rather disconcerting might be putting it mildly. It can be completely disorienting when that happens. Now, that comparison of Shakespeare and the Bible might not resonate for a whole pile of reasons with different people. For some, it won't resonate because they hold beliefs that mean those two documents couldn't possibly be in the same category, as in God dictated one but not the other. For some, it won't resonate because personally digging into either of those collections of texts has never been something the person has made a priority. And for some, it might not resonate because both Shakespeare and the Bible are on a good day, just not that interesting or are even repugnant or easily dismissed for a variety of reasons, including the fact that both those collections of work contain obvious racism and violence against persons, and we could go on misogyny. But I am just going to go out on a limb here and say that if you are tracking along in this series at all, you've probably been deeply impacted by the content of the Bible. In fact, I would go so far as to say that if you grew up in a Western culture, even if you were like a third generation atheist, you've been deeply impacted by the content and ideas contained in the Bible, at least as they have been interpreted and applied to the formation of society and culture by the combined influences of church and state. You might recall our explorations around the doctrine of discovery, this sort of so-called Christian doctrine, which asserted that lands belonged to the Christian powers or nations that, again, quotes, discovered them. And there was a related concept to the doctrine of discovery called terra nullius, which held that those on the land prior to the European arrival, they merely occupied it without any right or title, sort of like accidental guests, or maybe more like highly evolved animals, for which European thought might have used a word, did use a word like savages, right? Those ideas, which when we say them like that, we might kind of go, meh, really? Those ideas have been built into the legal systems of the Dominion of Canada, and they continue to reverberate into our century, into today. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission noted in its final report that the doctrine of discovery has been cited in decisions of the Supreme Court of Canada as recently as the 1990s. So lest we think that those things have limited impact in this, the peoples that occupy this continent, you know, we need to rethink that. I recently heard Buffy St. Marie comment that the doctrine of discovery should more correctly be called the doctrine of domination. Yeah. So no matter what we call it, it's a pretty hard idea to square with Jesus' teaching that in a kingdom where things are just, the typical order of who matters most will often be upended because the kind of values that drive the hubris of something like the doctrine of discovery are not the way that love operates. Or to put it another way, being rich and powerful as measured in material terms doesn't give you or me or anybody else the right to dominate others, whether we drag God into it or not. And if you study that first shall be last shall be first collection of texts that I was just alluding to, if you study that group of texts even for a few minutes, one of the things you'll see right away is that Jesus also did not mean that being poor automatically means that you are just and fair. Being oppressed does not automatically mean that you are just and fair. If you're a human enacting values like justice, equality, fairness, love, those are always a choice, period. Unquestionably, they are easier to enact under some circumstances than others. They are easier to enact when we have more agency. That agency does not remove our choice. And something like the doctrine of discovery being enacted on an entire people, an entire continent of people, I think is a good illustration of how countries and thinkers and explorers and colonizers who had the choice did not choose the path of love, but of dominance. So we always have this choice. Now, I took the time for all of that because it felt like a currently relevant example of an issue where we can increasingly see the need for a major course correction from a path that was formed by people who looked at a sacred text, said, it means this, and then had the power to visit that interpretation onto others. In things like the formation of dominions, and the making of laws, and the establishment of courts of law to influence those constitutions and laws and so on. For many of us, myself included, one of the upshots of that destructive choice has been that we have lived and continue to live a rather privileged life. That's complex, isn't it? So, what happens inside of us if we're in that situation? What happens inside of that space where we're trying to make meaning, we're trying to explore what we believe, when we come to an idea that has undergirded such huge aspects of our lived experience and we feel like we no longer know what those words mean? Well, one way to explore that might be to ask another question, such as, what does it feel like to live in a culture and time when your place, when my place in the world is changing, and when being X, whatever we understand ourselves to be, and in this case, for me, I might say a white person with settler ancestry, what happens when we live in a culture and time where our place in the world no longer seems to mean what it once did? For many of us, and for many people around us, it might feel like it's hard to know who to trust. So, for example, if the institutions of religion in which many of us were raised are revealing themselves to be not only complicit in outrageous crimes against innocent people, but instrumental in providing and defending, in the name of God, the very frameworks that justified those crimes, like the doctrine of discovery, and that those same institutions were partners in the implementation of those frameworks, in their outworking on the lives, culture, bodies of other human beings. What does that mean about all the other things we might have learned in those same settings? So, for example, if religious community was an important framework in which we learned that, let's say, it's important to forgive those who hurt us, or we learned that it's important to care for those that have less than we do, or we learned that it matters to be honest in our dealings with one another, our business dealings, our personal relationships, and so on and so forth. We could make a long list of good, important, beautiful things that we might have learned in those settings. What happens when those important things that we learned in those settings are revealed as lessons learned in the very communities that are also places of dominance and violence and cultural destruction? You may not have this experience, but I know many people do. One of the things that sometimes happens is we start to wonder if we can trust anything we learned there or anyone we might have learned it from in that context. As Tim, Misty, and Tasha all explored this past July, how do we navigate the terrain of keeping the good stuff and discarding the rest, of you know, having a rummage sale with the contents of our meaning-making closet, at the end of which we might discover that there's not much left in there? Well, that's obviously not a question to answer with a formula or, you know, with three easy steps. It's more like a question onion, where every time you peel off one layer, you find another one, and sooner or later, most of the layers make you cry, at least for a while. Also tasty, though. Right? So it's still there. That tension's still there. Well, obviously, that's not a question to answer with a formula, as I said. But there are some things that we can learn that might help us navigate all of this with, as I said last week, a bit more grace, a bit more kindness, a bit more hope. As Cheryl reminded us this morning, a bit more love. And again, these are things to push off from. These are things to examine to see what is for us to pick up and what isn't. So I'm going to work through the same grid of categories that I've used for the other stages, and I'll post a comparison chart of all of this on our Facebook page once we get through the whole list. That'll probably be after next week, since I'm only going to get about halfway through that schema today. And just a reminder again that, as always, it's helpful to work to resist or ignore the idea that this way of examining our own evolution as persons, we need to resist the idea that this is linear, or that this is a stand on this, stand on this, stand on this kind of progression toward becoming some kind of super spiritual person. I think if the spiritual masters teach us anything, it's that the path toward wholeness or oneness is at best circuitous, and more often we have the sensation of it leading down as much as up, or leading backward as much as leading forward. So just hold that while we kind of do the work of, here's some ideas that we can set next to one another and examine. So in stage three of our journey through doubt and the examination of our belief, in stage three, our perception, our 30,000 foot view of the world, tends to be dominated by a critical and relativistic mindset. That's sort of the overview. We tend to focus on things in stage three, like being honest and authentic, and we want our experiences to reflect that. We're often pretty motivated when it comes to seeing through the way things appear to be and trying to see something that is closer to what we might think of or hope for as reality. That's a tricky idea, that one, because our poking around in relativism, which we often do in this stage, might make us wonder if reality, at least as an ultimate value, is a perceivable thing at all. And that can lead us to a place where we might decide that what's real is what's real to me, sort of true to my own self, and sort of a banner ad for that perspective might be the kind of live your own truth idea, which I'm not going to examine in any more detail this morning, except to say that here's a feature of the stage for many of us. In our drive to seek out authentic experiences, we often value things like being fair. In this stage, we value things like acknowledging bias and mistakes. We value things like facing inconvenient truths. And this is a stage where we often become pretty highly attenuated to people or organizations that are aware of our drive toward that authenticity, aware of our acknowledgement of bias and mistakes and things that are true but don't fit easily into our preferred way of living. We become really attenuated to people or organizations that are aware of that drive and that value and that manipulate it to try to win our trust. Sort of announce their authenticity, announce their trustworthiness, announce their commitment to telling the truth about this, even if it hurts, and so on and so forth, right? It's easy to become cynical about this. I heard someone recently describe the outworking of this institutionally sometimes as being like saying you're sorry for doing something so you can keep on doing it. When systemic injustices are not addressed in meaningful, practical, hands-on change ways, that's what that can feel like. We're so sorry for having done this terrible thing in the past and for having made this harmful system. By the way, we're going to keep on using it. That can feel like that, right? So we become really attenuated to those kind of things in stage three. By the way, one of the critiques that I expect surfaces for folks about the table would be around this category. I could easily imagine that that people might look at the table both from outside and perhaps from inside, depending what their experiences have been like, and say this is just another community that's picked up on some current buzzwords or values, and it's using them, it's kind of broadcasting them to grow its own competing iteration of a thing that, we might call church or something like that. That's really interesting to me, a critique like that. Not because it has no merit, because of course that's a vulnerability, a real one for a community like this. But because of a phrase that I know Judy has used a couple of times, Judy Heppner, for talking about this dynamic, where she's talked about, rather than communities of shared belief, communities of shared affection. I remember many, many years ago, someone explaining to me that one of the ways to lessen the positive destructive impact of attraction to people we shouldn't be attracted to because of our relational framework, commitments we already have, is to actually get to know them. That it's much easier to be drawn into things that are destructive to us as persons if we don't have actual relationship with the people involved. When we critique something that we love, we're doing important work. It benefits us, it benefits the community, potentially. When we critique something from outside, when we don't know it, when we haven't been involved in trying to actually help it live and thrive, it's very easy to be harsh and judgmental and negatively critical. This is one of the reasons why things that separate us from actual human-to-human interaction and relationship make it easier to be mean. One of the reasons why meanness thrives in a place like social media, right? Where there aren't actual relationships, where we're not looking somebody in the eye when we stab them in the heart, if you will. It changes the dynamic. That is not my way of saying that this would not be a legitimate critique if leveled at the table. It is my way of saying that if somebody wants to critique the table, they're going to do their best critical work by actually getting to know the community and some people in it, and then bringing that critical thinking, that attention to bias, that attenuation to the ways in which ideas can be manipulated to cause others to behave in ways that are beneficial to the collective or to some individuals in the collective. Go be a double agent, you know, go inside and get to know people and love people, and then bring in the critique. And among other things, I think the critique will have more nuance and more depth, and there will also be a different kind of receptivity from within a community to that critique, which is more likely to produce what is often needful change, right? Anyway, an aside. In stage three, one of our prevailing assumptions is that everyone has an opinion, that every viewpoint is a view from a point, and that there is nothing or almost nothing that we would regard as universally true. That's a pretty common place to sort of find ourselves in stage three. In stage three, we're not big fans of authority figures. We've just seen too many of them behave like manipulators who control the naive and the trusting and the vulnerable to their own benefit. And you might remember that there's a part of this schema, we haven't sort of been in the grid of it for a while, but there's a part of this schema that deals with how in different stages we think differently about the question of them and us and that dynamic. And in stage three, well, I feel like we could camp out on this one for quite a while, just because there's so much of this dynamic surrounding us in our culture and in our world these days. And maybe we'll kind of auger into that more another time. But for now, what I wanted to do is just note that in stage three, we're not in the mode we were in stage one, which was sort of this good versus evil mode. We thought about them and us in those terms more in stage one. There's the good folks, and which we're part of, and then everybody else is evil and needs to be won over to the good, like converted, basically, or perhaps destroyed, depending on how sort of aggressive we are with our application of good versus evil, right? That it would be a gift to humanity to get the evil people off the planet. That's the kind of idea that can thrive in stage one. So in stage three, we're not there. We're not in good versus evil mode. And we're not in the mode that we were in stage two, which is winners versus losers. Interesting dynamic around that, that someone pointed out to me last week, which is the label for stage two is complexity. And they were just saying, well, because stage two has so many dualisms in it, so many us versus thems in it, isn't complexity sort of not a great word for that? Excellent point. And my response to them was that the complexity of this is that in stage two, we're all sort of often test driving what's going to help us be received by the people we perceive as the winners. What do I have to say? How do I have to behave? What do I have to at least say I believe? What sort of values do I have to enact? How do I even have to look? You know, those kind of things to be accepted by the winners. And that constant testing of who are the winners and what do I need to do to be. To meet their boundary markers and be in that group and to be a winner, that's a very complex process. Think junior high and trying to get into the in-group and how complex that can feel. So hence the moniker complexity, which has some limitations as well, right? Anyway, all to say, so we're not in stage one, good versus evil mode when it comes to them and us. We're not in the winners versus losers model that we were in stage two. In stage three, when it comes to being judgy, which is sort of what this is about, our tendency is to lean more toward asking if someone is being honest or being dishonest. Can they be trusted? Do we not find them trustworthy? I find it interesting how there's some categories in every stage that kind of pull us back toward a binary. They pull us back toward either-or-ness. That's not an easy thing to shed, especially if we've grown up with it. And I find this interesting more and more often when I talk about these things with adolescents or young adults. I feel like I'm talking to people who are much better equipped for this aspect of exploring belief and living with beliefs that are different from whatever beliefs they hold. Because one of the beliefs they more naturally seem to hold is that there's lots of different beliefs, and that's okay. And things don't have to be put into us versus them categories nearly so much. They just seem better equipped for it than I find myself and my generation often being. In stage three, life isn't a war like it might have been in stage one. It's not a game like it might have been in stage two. It's more like a quest, or maybe like a deception, or even even like a bit of a joke. Now, if that last one feels like it rubs you the wrong way or like it kind of doesn't belong, just ask yourself, when was the last time you thought someone was being too sincere or too earnest about something? Maybe, and particularly, I feel like this shows up in the arts, you know? Interesting movie, a little too earnest. Interesting song, a little too sincere. Not sure I can believe that much sincerity, you know, that kind of thing. That's more what I'm trying to get at when I talk about life being a joke. Now, you might be able to guess if you are someone that I know and that knows me, or that you've been around the table for a while, you might be able to guess that for me at least, the most resonant of those options is that life is a quest. That life is pressing into something so mysterious that we can tell at almost every turn that our best imaginings about it are coming up short, or they're gesturing in a kind of meaningful direction, but they're also clearly not taking us to a destination so much as they are moving us along an unfolding journey, where sometimes we don't even feel like we have a good picture or a good grasp of what the destination might be. But we're taking the next step. We're finding what we can to help us keep moving, you know? All of those things, and more that we'll explore next week, taken together can contribute to that perplexity that we started out talking about. When we're busy taking things apart, it can be hard to know what it feels like to also be making something that we find trustworthy or believable. When the people who told us what the lines in the book meant turn out to be untrustworthy, and if we do go back for ourselves to have a look at those lines, we discover that we don't know what they mean or if they mean anything in particular at all. And when the guiding story that we were taught clearly has not guided some of the most high-profile teachers of that story, it can get hard to know what's real and what isn't. And we can start to feel like doubt isn't just a constant, but it's a consuming constant. And that can be perplexing. Because, as Jan Martel says in his novel Life of Pi, choosing doubt as a philosophy of life is akin to choosing immobility as a means of transportation. Choosing doubt as a philosophy of life is akin to choosing immobility as a means of transportation. Very pithy. There's some things that I would challenge about it personally, but I also like that it reminds me that that constant disassembly or deconstruction is not a space where it's easy to thrive. That's for sure. So, I mean, what to do? What to do, right? Because this taking apart of things is so essential to this stage. It feels like the natural engine for doubt in stage three. Tongue in cheek, what I wrote in my notes here is, join us next week when Tim answers all these questions and many more. Because of course you know that's exactly what'll happen next week, right? That was sarcasm. Just in case, just to be abundantly clear. That's where I'm gonna leave it, right there. So partway through the grid of comparing these things in stage three to stage two and one and zero. We'll pick it up again there next week. For now, let me just say that it's not just okay to live with the doubts and the questions. And it's not even just important to live with the doubts and the questions. The doubts and the questions, if we do not begin with the premise that we have to eliminate them to thrive, the doubts and the questions can be the exact stuff that keeps us spiritually animated, keeps us engaged, keeps us paying attention to the world around us. All of it, not just the easy bits, but the complex, perplexing bits, the parts that really challenge us, the parts that make us wonder if there's anything that's believable in an ongoing, deepening, trustworthy sort of way. That can enliven us spiritually. But we have to be open to that. It's not going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen to us. Like, we have to engage with that for it to be a part of how we experience the world. More on that another day. Thank you for listening. I'm really grateful to be part of a community where we can wrestle with these things together and not be afraid. I think that's very beautiful.